So we're rounding out the discussion really with more on the scope of the scope and the nature of what the work of the church is. And thought it would be good to focus a little bit more on this this notion of kind of individual versus church. You know, and if one is the same, if the work of one is the work of the other, because that really, from some of the reading that I've done, you know, and I'm sure things that you're aware of as well, a lot of the disagreements and issues that have arisen over the course of years has really kind of focused in on what is the church supposed to do, and is the work of the church the same as the work of an individual, and so instructions and duties and obligations that we have as individual Christians, are those really the same upon the church as well? And then that just kind of applies to whatever topic you're talking about, whether it's how to, you know, teach the gospel, or whether it's especially in the area of, you know, doing good works and what the scope of those is, and whether it fits within the scope of what the church is supposed to do with its funds and resources as a collective kind of activity. So I thought I'd start with just taking a look over in Matthew chapter 18, if you want to turn over there, something that Jesus taught. And we'll start reading at verse 15. And this isn't really so much about the work of the church, but there's a point here that I think we can draw out of what he was saying. So starting in verse 15, Jesus says, "And if your brother sins, go and reprove him in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer." And so I think the point that we can kind of draw out of that, and I think that Jesus infers there, is that that there is a distinction actually between individuals and the church, right? Because he talks about in this type of a situation, first you talk to individuals, and then maybe you talk to a couple of individuals, maybe a small group of individuals, and then sort of the third step is going and talking to the church. So it seems that, you know, you can't really say that, or I think there's a distinction to be made there then, that the church is not an individual, or the individual is not the church, or even a group of individuals within a church is not the church as a whole. And so I think that, you know, as I was saying, this is an area that I think needs to be, you know, clearly understood, and where I think that there have been a lot of, you know, issues and disagreements within, I would say, within local churches, not maybe not so much within the Lord's body universal, because I'm not sure that there really are divisions within the Lord's body. But I think that, you know, there have been divisions within within local churches. And then this is something, too, that Paul writes about in, if we turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and this is a passage we've looked at before when we were talking about the church as the body of Christ. So 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And he's talking about the body of Christ here. He draws out this rather lengthy analogy of the church being the body. But just to notice a couple of quick verses. So verse 20, he says, "But now there are many members, but one body." And then dropping down to verse 27, "Now you are Christ's body and individually members of it." So, you know, similar to this idea, we could also say that members, right, don't equal the body, but the members make up the body. So I think those are a couple of key points just to understand that there is a distinction, you know, borne out in the scriptures between individuals who make up the church, or members who make up the body of Christ, and the church or the body itself. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 5, because there's an area here where Paul gives some instructions about personal responsibilities that we have. And we're kind of moving into
we're going to get into this morning, this notion of, you know, doing good works or you know, the term benevolence, and figuring out, you know, what's within the scope of the church, and then maybe broaden that out, too, to some other activities that may or may not be within the scope of the church. But in 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul's writing to Timothy. He's giving these instructions about personal responsibilities, particularly with regard to one's own family and how to care for one's own family. And so we see, for instance, in verse 4, he writes, "But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for it is acceptable in the sight of God." So just establishing that there is this personal responsibility that Christians have to care for members of our own families. Similarly, if we drop down to verse 8, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Okay, so there's, and this is kind of second nature, right? But we can establish this fact that we have a personal responsibility to care for members of our own family. So then, thinking about this distinction between individuals and church, is that something that is the responsibility of the church then, or is there a distinction? And I think Paul kind of clarifies that actually as he goes through this discussion, and then he gets into this topic of widows and which widows can be supported by the church, and he concludes in verse 16. If we look at that, he writes, "If any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, let her assist them, and let not the church be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed." So in this context, this discussion where Paul is instructing Timothy about personal responsibilities that Christians have to care for members of our families, he draws out this distinction that there are certain responsibilities that Christians have that the church does not have because, it just doesn't fit within what the church is to do. And so that's Paul's instruction there to Timothy. So I think that's an important data point to keep in our minds, that there is this distinction borne out in the scriptures between what individuals are to do versus what the work of the church is. And when we say work of the church, what we're really talking about there is using the resources of the church and engaging in an activity as a collective sort of corporate activity of the church, not just something that maybe groups of us are doing on our own. So,
any questions about that? Makes
sense. Okay. Do you think that he's talking about relatives rather than immediate family? If this woman has anyone in her family, any who's a believer has widows in the family.
Well, I think the way I understand that this kind of, we didn't go through this entire text here, but it's really talking about widows that fit a certain set of criteria that Paul is instructing Timothy about, and those that meet this certain criteria are eligible for the church essentially to provide living support to. He uses the term, widows indeed. So they've got to be of a certain age. They've got to be at least 60 years old. They had to have lived faithfully, wife of one husband, and so forth. So as you go down through that list of criteria, that's really what he's talking about there are widows. But he draws this distinction also between widows that don't meet that criteria and how they are to be cared for, and concluding then in verse 16 that it's not the work of the church. Let not the church be burdened, he actually says, with caring for our widows that don't meet the certain criteria. So I think we draw out from that there's a pretty narrow set of criteria for the church to, provide living support to.
And it's interesting that it says if any woman makes that distinction between men and women.
Right. Yeah. So I thought it would maybe be useful if we thought about it this way. If there's a scope of work
that we'll say is, and we'll just say activities of Christians, right? And then I think that there's also, probably aren't the right size, but activities of the church. And when we say church here, I think we're really talking about local churches, because that's where decisions come down to, you know, what we're going to be involved in, what we're going to use our funds for, and what kind of work we're going to be doing. So, and then I think that there's some overlap. I think there are, we'll see that there's activities that are duties of Christians, activities of Christians that really don't fall within the scope of the church. There's going to be some overlap, though. And I think a lot of the discussions and disagreements and debates over the years have focused on whether there are activities where there's instructions given to Christians and trying to put those into a work or an activity of the church. So we can start with listing we could probably spend all day filling out activities of Christians, but I thought we'd just highlight a couple to kind of illustrate the point. So if we turn over to Ephesians chapter 6. I think I will make these bigger, actually. Ephesians chapter 6, and then just if somebody could just read verse 4 there.
The Father, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord.
Okay. So what would we say the activity there is that is being instructed?
Fathering.
Okay, fathering, raising children. Okay. And, I think that we would all agree that's pretty clearly, the work of individual fathers or parents, right? Raising children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Right? That's not a activity of the church. It's not a duty that's given to the church. The one that we had already read, 1 Timothy 5:8. Okay. Basically, supporting kind of goes along with this first one, but supporting our family is an activity of individual Christians. Other instructions that are given to us, for example, Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. So I think the instruction there, right, is obey the laws of the land, and that's something that we do as individual Christians.
The church has to obey the laws of the land, too.
True, yeah. There are certain laws that churches have to abide by as well. So maybe we could put that one over here in an overlap. Okay.
2 Thessalonians. Second Thessalonians chapter 3. And someone could just read verses 11 and 12 there.
For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons demand and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread.
Okay, so what's the instruction there, and who is it to? Is it to churches or to Christians?
Christians.
Yeah, and I think it's work.
And then,
work in a narrow sense that it's providing for the substance.
Right.
Work is a very generic term.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Providing kind of work. All right. Which then, I think, Dave, kind of to your point, then, if we look over at Galatians chapter 6.
Um, And there's a whole host of verses we could look at this for this particular point. But in Galatians chapter 6, and if we pick up the reading at verse 6, and let the one who is taught the word share all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh shall from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit shall from the Spirit reap eternal life. And let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we shall reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. Okay, so I think the teaching here is the doing good. Which is defined, you know, that's a pretty broad term. And I think that this is probably one of the passages that is looked to try to move things from this very broad and general category of, you know, doing good into, you know, something that is deemed to be a work of the church because it is something that is doing good. But,
you know, the instruction here, as I read through this, this is all about what individuals are to do. You know, really even starting back up in verse 1 of that text. So, for now, let's put doing good here, and we can kind of, you know, maybe, I think Mike suggested the term last week about humanitarian kind of good, but also we'll say, you know, would include, I think, spiritual good, teaching, those sorts of things. So then, you know, we've talked a lot about work of the church in the last couple of weeks. So what are some of the things we've noted here that you know, we've clearly identified are a part of the work of the church? Okay, yeah. Right, we talked about edification. Okay, and we each have that responsibility, but so does the church. Okay, teaching. Preaching. There aren't that many items, really, that we've listed and really have identified our works of the church. How about the reason that we're here today? Something that we engage in collectively, right? Worship, okay. That's something that we do as individuals, but we really also do it collectively. So there are these parallel activities that Christians are instructed to do, but that also churches, we've seen examples where churches were engaged and involved in these things as well. And then this topic that we'll look at some examples for, which we'll say caring for needy saints. All right.
So if we turn and look at, you know, we can just flip through the scriptures and see some examples of where churches have been involved and engaged in caring for needy saints. And what we can try to do is identify kind of the... there's enough space here. When we look at each of these examples, who's being supported and how that's happening, I think that will be... helpful and instructive as we go through this. So if we start in Acts chapter 2, and a lot of these naturally will come out of the book of Acts, where we see, you know, the church first beginning its activities and Christians working as a part of the church. So in Acts chapter 2, and some of these we've looked at before, but Acts chapter 2, if someone could read verses 44 and 45. The context here, of course, we've looked at is you know, we're in Jerusalem. Peter's just preached. The apostles have just preached and revealed the gospel, and thousands are coming to the gospel, and they're all there together in Jerusalem, and they've come from all parts of the world, really to observe, you know, from the Passover to the Feast of Pentecost, which is when the church, you know, began. And we pick up in someone could read verses 44 and 45 then.
All those who had believed were together and had all things in common. And they began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have needed.
Okay. So
how do we think about then from this passage the who part? Who's getting the care or the support in this example? Okay.
Right. So it starts with all those who had believed, right, in verse 44.
That kind of sets up who we're talking about in these verses. So all who had believed were together. And then of that, there's a subset in verse 45 that we're getting the support, and it's anyone who had need. Right? So they weren't supporting everyone in the city of Jerusalem. It was really defined to, or confined to those who had believed. That's the context of who's being described there in those verses. And then how was this support provided to these saints? Okay. Right.
Individual contributions.
Yeah. Right. Individuals were selling their properties and providing contributions. So individuals contributed. And then there was a sharing involved. Right. And it even uses the term having all things in common.
Okay. So there's one example. And we're just going to go through and notice a number of these. So then if we go forward into Acts chapter 4, we find something similar. And let's see if someone would read verses 32 through 35.
The congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common property to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all. For there was not a needy person among them, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales, and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as any had need.
Okay.
So let's set this out then. Who's being supported then? How's it?
Those who believe.
Okay, right, exactly. So we've got the who of what we're talking about is the congregation of those of believers. Okay, those who believed.
And if you tie verse 34 to the needy among them.
Right, right. The needy among them. All right. And then I think we get a little more detail in this example about how the care was being provided. What do we see there?
We give it to the apostles.
Okay, right. So same idea here. There's individuals contributed. You know, they sold their property, and it says that they laid it at the apostles' feet. So at least I get from that, it wasn't that, you know, Barnabas sold a piece of property and then he gave it necessarily to an individual Christian, although there may have been some of that going on because there certainly was a sharing and having all things in common. But there was also this notion of, you know, providing whatever contribution a person had available and really giving it to the group as a whole by bringing it to the apostles, and then from there it would be distributed out to those that had need. I think we can add that too. So there's kind of three pieces of this. There's the individual selling, there's the laying it at the apostles' feet, and then there's the distribution to those needy saints.
Okay. And then we'll see a consistent pattern if we look at Acts chapter 6. And we're still, you know, dealing with Christians in the city of Jerusalem here. Acts chapter 6, now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food. And the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, it is not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. But, you know, the select men, we've looked at that in the past. So there appears to have been a distribution of food that was going on, right? And who was receiving this support?
Widows.
Okay, right.
Primarily it's talking about the widows in this passage. But.
Right, right. And it starts off with, in verse 1 there, it starts with the disciples. Mm-hmm. Right, so we're still talking about a defined population of the disciples, and then within that, there was a subset of Hellenistic. So, widows who weren't native to Jerusalem or Judea or even Palestine, but widows who had traveled, you know, from the Greek part of the world into Jerusalem for the Passover and Pentecost, had believed and were being supported, it appears, by this daily distribution of food. So we'll add that to this is how it was. Similar here, we noticed there was a distribution up here, and here there's a daily distribution caring for these widows. Okay. Let's look at Acts chapter 11. Now we're dealing with churches outside of Jerusalem, although it involves Jerusalem. So in Acts chapter 11, Christians are at Antioch, but some prophets come to Antioch and predict this famine that's going to happen in Jerusalem. So if we pick up the reading of verse 27, now at this time some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and one of them named Agabus stood up and began to indicate by the Spirit that there would be certainly a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius, and in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. And this they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. Okay. So, who do we see as the ones receiving care in this example? Okay, so we've got... Right. We've got Christians in Judea are the ones receiving this support. And then what's the practice that we see the church in Antioch doing in order to provide this support? Right. Right. So again, we've got individual contributions, okay, and what does it say about how it was being sent? Okay, right, sent by, let's read it here, Barnabas and Saul
to the elders,
right. So there's an example. It's a little bit different than what we've seen up here so far. In some way, I think necessitated by the fact that it had, you know, this support had to be transported some distance, right? But it's similar to this notion up here where a contribution was laid at the apostles' feet and then distributed. Here, there's a contribution. It's given, you know, via Barnabas and Saul. They carry it. And then it's given to the elders at Jerusalem to distribute to the needy saints. All right. And then we read more about examples like that, and we get into some of Paul's letters, because as he's writing these letters, he's in the process of either collecting aid like this or on the way to deliver aid specifically to Jerusalem and Judea. So if we look over in Romans chapter 15... Romans 15 And if we start reading at verse 22, "For this reason I have often been hindered from coming to you, but now with no further place for me in these regions, and since I have had for many years a longing to come to you whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing, and to be helped on my way there by you, when I have first enjoyed your company for a while. But now I am going to Jerusalem, serving the saints, for Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem." Yes, they were pleased to do so, and they are indebted to them, for the Gentiles have shared in their spiritual things. They are indebted to minister to them also in material things. Okay, so there's some aid being delivered here. Who's receiving the aid?
Poor among the saints.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So poor saints, or let's say needy saints in Jerusalem. And what do we know about how the aid was being provided in this example?
First contribution.
Okay.
Was made, and then the transport.
Right. So similar example. So it's the churches, right? Churches of Macedonia. And it's sent by Paul. He had others traveling with him as well. And a contribution mentioned there as well. Okay. So pretty consistent pattern of examples, I think, that we're seeing here as far as who gets the aid and how it's provided. We can look also at 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And we just noticed the first four verses there. "Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me." All right. I think I read that right. So here again, the aid is being provided to Jerusalem. Doesn't say specifically saints or church there, but I think, you know, we can see that's what Paul was doing in this example, and it's the pattern of how the aid was being provided in other instances we've looked at. And again, it's a contribution, and it's delivered. By Paul to the church there in Jerusalem.
And then we won't take the time to read it, but if we turn over, read 2 Corinthians verses 8 and 9. He's on his way to Corinth to pick this up, and he's making the point, okay, well, you said you're going to make this contribution. Make sure it's ready when we get there so that the people I'm with aren't disappointed with how I've explained to them how you've made this, you've agreed and committed to make this contribution, and making sure that it's actually available and they follow through with what they had committed to do. And then we'll go back. Let's turn back over to 1 Timothy chapter 5 now and look at more of the specifics about this care for widows.
If I can get someone to read verses 3 through 16.
Okay. "Honor widows who are really widows, but any widow has children or grandchildren, but the firstborn to show getting home and irritated the parents, but this is good and something before God. Now she was really widow and left alone, trusting God and continuing supplication and prayer from night to day. But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. And these things command that they may be blameless. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith is worse than an unbeliever. Not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number, and not unless she has been the wife of one man. Well rewarded for good works. If she has brought up children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. But refuse the younger widows, for when they have begun to grow wanton against Christ and desire to marry, having condemnation because they have cast off their first faith. And besides, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not. Therefore, I desire that the younger women, widows, marry, bear children, manage the house, give them opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some have already turned aside after Satan. If any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows.
Okay. So those receiving the aid in this example are, sometimes we use the term widows indeed, or those that, we'll say certain widows, and it's certain widows because what are the various criteria here that Paul lays out as he instructs Timothy? And I think it really starts back around verse 9.
Under 60.
Okay.
Over 60.
Right, over 60.
Wife of one.
Right, wife of one. Okay. Reputation for what? What kind of reputation?
Good works.
Okay, right. So, someone who's done good works.
Raise children.
Right, raise children.
Hospitality.
Yeah, right. Hospitality. Okay. And there's not a specific need that's identified here, except I think, you know, we know that widows who would have fit this criteria, they would have had a need for some support, you know, at this time in history and in this, you know, particular society. So there's a way that the apostles, you know, arranged the church to help provide for the welfare of these specific saints. Okay. Other than that, so you know, we kind of add this all up, and it seems that the clear pattern then of churches, you know, providing some sort of care for, you know, if we go back to this kind of notion of humanitarian aid, really what we see, what the church did and what the apostles taught and carried out was, you know, care for specific saints that had specific needs, and the way in which it was conducted was, you know, churches providing to those Christians. So what, and what we talked about then, is there anything we can think of that would go over kind of in this part of the diagram that is a work of the church that's not really a part of the work of Christians? I kind of struggled myself coming up, you know, thinking about if there was anything. The only thing that I'm not sure that there's a clear thing you can put over here that's not really the work of churches, but, and we haven't gotten into this topic, and I would like to have, but maybe next time we do this, but there's the notion of discipline, right? That's something that the church does collectively. Christians are involved in that, so pretty easily you can put it in here as well. But as far as disciplining members who aren't, you know, walking correctly, living correctly, that's, you know, that, I think you could think about that maybe as, okay, that's a corporate activity of the church. The church disciplines itself. But obviously Christians are involved in anything that the church does, so it's hard to really say that that's an exclusive example there. All right, so we talked in the last
few weeks about, you know, what the work of the church is. So,
The actual distribution is something that is a work of the church.
Yeah.
You know, the distribution of the money, it's not up to the individual. So, I mean.
Ah, okay, yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying. So the distribution of this. Yeah. Yeah, I thought about that. So like the contribution part of it is over here. Okay. Yeah, both Christians and the church have this responsibility to care for needy saints. But once it's contributed to the church, then it's the church's duty to do the actual distribution. Which, of course, to do that uses Christians. Okay.
The church is Christians.
Right. Right. It gets a little, But that's where that's where some of the confusion and debate has certainly been, over the years. So.
Yeah, the difference is individual versus collective.
Yeah, right. Right. That's a better way to think about it. So what are some activities that we could think of and identify, and maybe we see churches involved in that really don't fit this model or this pattern that we've seen now for several weeks kind of reading through different passages and examples.
In the context of monetary or?
Activities that, think broadly about churches, right? Churches in our area. What are some activities we see churches getting involved in that aren't really within the scope of what God designed the church?
Yes.
Okay, right. So, secular education. Okay.
Sports.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Recreation. Right.
My friend literally goes to, I won't say the name of it, once I'm saying the congregation, but a non-denominational church, and they have Starbucks in the morning.
Okay.
According to her husband, she does more Starbucks than she does church.
Okay. How about things maybe, so those are pretty easy examples to think about. How about
missionary societies?
Okay. So missionary society, right, doesn't fit the pattern. Now, that one gets a little closer to the work of the church, right, because there's, we've talked about this, there's teaching that is the objective of a missionary society. But what we see, in the passages we studied the last couple of weeks, we don't see where churches, pooled together or where there was a central organization that various churches contributed to, and then that organization sent the money off to preachers. We really see churches sending support directly to Paul in a lot of examples, or other teachers to support them in their teaching. But that's that's a common organizational kind of hierarchy construct that people have come up with. But it doesn't fit the pattern. But you can see people rationalizing it because there's teaching going on. How about medical services, right?
Humanitarian disaster relief.
Okay, right. Disaster relief. Now, there have been some disasters this year, right? And the elders have even gotten up and announced about, I don't think we've actually sent any to any flood victims or tornado, but we've been looking for.
Did during the hurricanes of Katrina and the other one that hit Houston.
Yeah.
There was some family there that.
The one after that, that's right. Yeah. And when we did that, though, how did we send the aid?
I don't remember exactly. It seemed like there was some person there we sent it to, and we knew how to distribute it to the saints.
Okay, right. And it was aimed at saints. So I guess disaster relief, kind of, broad, right? contributing to the Red Cross or something would not be, you know, would not fit this pattern of how we see benevolence and care provided to needy saints.
That's in signs, you know, some of the churches that are named that only have like 2 patients in essence, you know, 1 day a week.
Okay.
The public.
Right. Right.
Or, you know, provide clothing. Or
yeah.
School supplies. Or,
you know, kind of general poverty relief.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really see that as a work of the church. And that may be maybe one of the hardest things to explain to people who really aren't familiar with the scriptures and aren't familiar with the teaching, because they may generally be familiar with, well, Jesus went around, did good, right? He healed people, he fed people. But he also established the church, and he also, you know, identified or established his apostles with the authority, and we've got the writing from the apostles. And we see the example from history of how the church operated, and it wasn't, you know, general poverty relief, and certainly that's not even why Christ came, right? Christ didn't come from heaven, die on the cross, and rise from the dead so that people could have 3 meals a day or, you know, any other number of things, you know, have a cup of coffee or have a basketball team or any of those types of activities. All right. That's actually about the end of what I had to go over. Ken, maybe put you on the spot. So we're talking about benevolence. Can you describe maybe a little bit, like, how do the elders get requests for benevolence, and how do you guys kind of think about, you know, when to provide that care for needy saints, and kind of what's the process? The
request comes from all sources, from members, from, you know, contacts outside the church.
Yeah.
Directly from needy people. And we have to, you know, assess whether or not the need is legitimate, and whether or not there's someone particularly, we look for somebody that knows the situation in that location,
like
Zimbabwe.
Right.
Somebody there that is trusted, and, you know, either we know or we know people who know him, but that we trust him to be able to know the needs of the people there and be able to distribute the funds as appropriate.
Right.
So that's the key thing, is to find somebody that's there that knows the situation in order to make a decision to contribute, because there's always needs. I mean, it's constant needs.
Right.
We can spend our bank account down to zero in a week if we
want
to, just from all the people that request funds. But we want to make sure that it's a real need. We've got somebody there that understands the situation and knows the problem with the pattern and skills.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So that's it. You know, as I had mentioned earlier, there's a ton of material on the church. There's topics we didn't even get into. There's other things to study. So hopefully this whets your appetite into further study, you know, about the church and the work of the church and, you know, other activities of the church. Like we mentioned, discipline, we really didn't get into that at all. I had intended to this quarter, but we didn't get into that and other topics too. So thank you all for participating and commenting in class. Appreciate
it. One of the activities I think belongs to the big circle on the right is, we don't do so much of it today, but in the scriptures we find where churches sent Paul and Barnabas to other locations to teach or to preach or to do relief or whatever.
Yeah.
A number of cases where churches sent somebody to go work. So there's a, and I don't know whether, we support preachers around the country, around the world, actually, in preaching. We don't actually send them from here, but we provide support for them to do that. So I think there's a function there that involves, what to call it. But
I see what you're saying.
It's almost like Christian outreach. That's not quite right either. But
it's kind of like this piece here. We've got it within the church circle. Maybe there's a piece of it that's the actual sending we could think of as kind of a collective activity when we identify and send somebody off to.
Other than that, you're right. There's not a lot.
Yeah.
That's really the collective function. It's not
exclusively, right. Yeah.
There's one verse in 1 Timothy 3:15 where it talks about the church is the pillar and the support of the truth. And I think the church is to protect the word.
Okay.
Which may not be
individually
at the same level. I was wrestling with that, whether or not that's really
But you're right, the church is identified there as the the pillar and support of the truth. The other thing that the church does is it shows the wisdom of God, right? We looked at that passage before over in Ephesians. But again, you know, it's hard to separate these from, I think at the church, as opposed to individual Christians, do these things.
What about the appointing of elders and deacons?
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. Appointing elders, not done by individuals. That's good. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.